Please join me in welcoming back Agnes Voda.
Thank you, thank you, thank you. Sit down, please.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much, Agnes, for sharing this remarkable, powerful film with us all and for being here now to speak with us about it. And I wanted to begin by speaking about cine-écriture, because I spoke about this a little bit in my introduction. And this idea of film writing is so powerful in this film that is also dedicated itself to a great writer, Nathalie Sarraute. And I was wondering if you could speak about this concept of cine-écriture and the relationship it might have to écriture, to literature, and the relationship that this film might have to the work of Nathalie Sarraute, who was a writer who you greatly esteemed and who you had, a personal connection and friendship with.
Yes, yes, yes. It is true that I've invented the word cine-écriture, cine-writing, because I'm pissed when people say the film is well written and they discuss the dialogue. This is not the film is not the dialogue. And we have to make so many choices to make a film. The choices of how to write it, how to film it, color, black and white, I don't know, traveling shots still. The choices are all the way through, and editing and choosing the music. So I could say that cine writing would be like style, like with the style for a writer, or l'écriture. So I start to say cine écriture. But the most thing I have in mind is that whatever you want to tell, to be a filmmaker, that's the way I feel, you have to find a structure for the film. You have to find a style, a structure, and make these choices as important as the story itself. Well, the story is what we know, We found her dead in the ditch, what happened in the last 3 months of her life, how her character is described by the way people about her, speak about her. She doesn't say too much. Why is she so rebel? Why is she on the road? And, well, all these things are related to the character. Beautifully played, acted by Sandrine Bonnaire, who was not even 18 when she did the film. And she had in herself enough rebellion, I would say, revolt, that she could make it like not even acting. Wonderful woman, very wonderful young woman. And about the structure, what I made clear for me, when I started to think, I thought, I have to tell them stories, the meeting she does with these people who don't like her, don't understand her, or have contempt or pity. And then she has to walk, because it's about people on the road. And then I understood, at the last minute, that the film, what she's walking, and the fact that she was meeting people is less important. It's like I switched the thing. So I decided 13 traveling shots. You have seen them, always from right to left. And that's where the film is. She walks. She walks in the earth. She walks on concrete. She walks in the woods. She walks on sand. So the structure of the film is these 13 travelings. And the story is what happens in between. And obviously, there is a kind of story, especially that nobody accept her unless that woman, specialist of trees, who tries to understand her a little, even though she's disgusted, even though she is impressed by the fact that she stinks so much, because the film is also not so much about poverty, but about cleanliness and not. Because we are in a civilization, people have to be clean, and nobody stands the people not clean. They say, she's poor but clean. I heard that, And then the fact that they hate to wash and they don't have the opportunity, but they don't care. about that. They stink and they go with in these places, comment s'appelle, the squat, where the squat, you know, it's disgusting. When we did the shooting, we couldn't believe it was so dirty. And I say to the crew, we have to pass, like you pass the wall of sound, you have to pass the world of smell.
Because the smell barrier, right.
Yeah, because we have to, and then we were there after 1 hour, we said, okay, this is, we don't think about it. So all these things, I was so impressed that that was describing her, but still the structure of the film. So if you want me to say something about Nathalie Sarraute, I liked her writing, which was very difficult because difficult to read, and she was not explaining so much about the characters. But what I had in mind, because she was a solitary writer, she was very different, she was original. They called everything called the Nouveau Roman, but she was much more interesting than the Nouveau Roman. Herself, she was a style, you know. And I had seen a photo of her. Somebody took a photo. She was in the field walking. And I remember I thought, she's a walking writer.
A walking writer. Yeah.
Because of her loneliness, not because she told story about the road. So sometimes it's like mental images. So I found her like a solitary writer, even though she was praised, etc. It's just, you know, you have the society thing and then you have the intimate feeling you have about things. So that's why I dedicate her. Plus, I admire her very much. And I think she was touched to receive that film.
Well, I feel in Nathalie Sarraute's writing, there's also an idea and an enigmatic and elusive idea about characters that sometimes exist more in the as figments than actual facts.
Not even totally described, not totally understood. Sometimes you don't even know who's speaking. Mm-hmm. As if the world is kind of chaos, mm-hmm. in which we have to catch, you know, some person and another one and find a relationship. But also, there is, I stole something from one of her books called Martyro, in which there are two nephews who look for the old aunt who has an apartment, and they would like her to die fast because they would like the apartment. And in the film, you have that,
right.
The young couple visiting her. They say, oh, yeah, ta-ta-ta. And then they bring flowers, and she's aware of that, you know. But they succeed to push her in the old people institution. So this, I borrowed that.
A petit homage. Now, the film begins with your own voice speaking, and you're speaking about you announce what the film will be about, the search for Mona, trying to understand who Mona is, and which leads me to the question, you're not present in the film, but with this voiceover at the beginning, it becomes very much your film, your search, your...
Well, that's part of something that, you know, when I was young, we were hiring actors to say the narration mm-hmm. that had written. And one day I said, hey, come on, I'm writing, I speak to you, why shouldn't I speak myself? So I started to put the narration of the shots in my film and never being there. And then I understood when you separate from the film that is finished, I thought, if I leave something, I'm still there. So I did the first sentence as if I couldn't separate from the film. But it's something I cannot explain. I wanted to be there a little.
Well, I'd like to know about your personal connection then to Mona, which I feel in this film. Like, where does she come from as a character for you? How was she born?
The point is, I'm not interested in the psychology of why she's on the road.
No, I'm not asking the psychology of that. I'm asking where she comes from to come into the film.
Yes, but it was not raised as a question because she could have been raped. She has been maybe beaten by her father, maybe she was out of jail, maybe she was, you know. I thought we should start how she succeeded to live,
okay.
How she succeeded to find, how to sleep, how to eat, how to not to be raped. Mm-hmm. It's just survival behavior. So when I spoke with Sandrine, we didn't discuss, and I tell that in my narration, I asked her to sleep in the woods. Mm-hmm. I asked her to learn how to put the backpack and put it back, you know, like gesture mm-hmm. and behavior. Mm-hmm. And we never discuss why should she be on the road. And
right, motivation. Right.
But it's interesting because most of the films are psychologically explained, or trying to explain them. And I was interested in how she survives, technically and physically. Mm-hmm. So it's a choice, you know. That's among the choices that you make before making a film.
But it's also about what other people think of her, right? I mean, so much of the film is she's a kind of prism through which the world, there's these different people she encounters along the way are seeing her, seeing the world, seeing themselves reflected, if you will, in their own hopes and desires. And I feel like this speaks to a larger idea that so many of your films are interested in, which is empathy, our ability to try to understand and to, right, and other people.
Very little empathy in the film because the people don't like her. She's a foreigner. She's a disturbance. She's a woman alone. She's dirty. She's not nice. She speaks bad. And the portrait is supposed to be made by the way they speak about her, but it's a puzzle. A lot of pieces are missing because they speak badly. You know, the little girl say she's free. But her mother say, you know, maybe she doesn't eat every day. And there is a very nice man, the mason, the worker, is the one who would say, poor girl on the road. But all the others have contempt. She's you know, steals. The garagist has contempt. So they don't like her at all. And by saying something, they build a little portrait of her. But so many pieces are missing. And she doesn't tell so much. She tells a little in the car with Madame Platane. And she says something that she learned to type. She was slightly knowing some English. So why did she quit? You know, we understand she doesn't want to have a little chief. She doesn't want to be part of society. We don't know more. That's what she said. Was it even true? So it's an impossible portrait. The portrait impossible to make. And then she's escaping. She's the first title was A Saisir. Try to catch her, which we never. And then I was at the editing and we thought a cowboy story was sans foi ni loi, you know, sans foi, no face, no law. It's a cowboy.
And so she has those almost cowboy boots, right?
And so I say sans toi ni loi. So which means no roof, no law, which made it vagabond, which is too vague. But that's the way.
I mean, if we could speak just, and you've these extraordinary 13 tracking shots, and I'd like to speak about the theme of walking, because you said something really interesting before speaking with a student where you said walking, peregrination, was an important theme of the Nouvelle Vague. It was something that was very much of the time. And I was wondering if this is something, this idea of going into the streets, going into the world. Is this
happens really at the time of the new wave. It's one of the things you see in most of the film. People walking in the street, discussing in the street, which was not before. They used to work a lot in the studio, or real landscape, real scenes. When you look at Romer, Godard, Truffaut, all these people, Lola and Jacques Demy, they are in the street to walk. And Cléo is crossing Paris also, and etc. So in that case, walking is a revolt. This, she's on the road as a reaction to society. Mm-hmm. And it was, well, at the time, you know, on the road, all that literature American. But what I noticed that there were young men on the road. And in the 80s, we started to see young women on the road. That was new. Women with backpack on the road was not there 10 years before. Mm-hmm. Is it a step of the feminism? I don't know. But it is clearly some women started to do what men were doing. Revolt, backpack, and here she goes. And I took a lot of hitchhiker to find out, you know. I would take them. I would drive alone, look for a location. I do that alone because I like to feel what people say. Sometimes, some farms, they would be mean to me because I was alone.
So, and you picked up a lot of hitchhikers as you were
also
doing research.
Men and women, to make them speak. Mm-hmm. But yes, because we have to learn before making it fiction. I document myself. And what they told me, I was so impressed, things I wouldn't believe. One who has a little backpack, very little things, you know, in it. And they never have anything like camping, like a knife that falls or something usable. They have a nose, like a kitchen knife or something, nothing. And one has a dictionary. And you know, it's interesting because I say, what happened? They say, well, I saw it near a garbage, I took it. So I have the feeling I have something with me. A dictionary, a French dictionary. So you always learn. In the reality, you learn things that you would never think of. Not that I put a dictionary in a bag. I'm saying we have to listen what people say, because inventing as a character is one thing, but getting some information from reality makes it more believable for me and more touching or more interesting. So I learned about this hitchhiker. And once I was with one very interesting woman, and she discussed, she was very vivid. I said, okay, let's stop, we go to a restaurant. We go and I have dinner, lunch. And we enter the restaurant and the man comes with, I don't want that one. She doesn't look clean enough. It was clear, they didn't want her. She looked dirty. So we had to buy something and eat it in the car. But what I'm saying, society is very rough to people who don't look good. It's just a theme I have in the Gleaners also.
Yes.
You know, the Gleaners are about the format, you know, of potatoes. Whatever is out of the format is thrown away. Society also has these rules. If you're not in the format clean, vaguely okay, etc., they push you out, you know.
Right, no, like the way in the Gleaners we see the potatoes that aren't perfectly formed are tossed in the garbage. So these people who meet Mona along the way, how did you meet them? How did they come into the film? Was this part of your research as you traveled around?
Yes, they are non-actors. But most of them I had found them before, like the garagist. I spoke with him and I said, can we come, etc. The farm in which they do the vin, the vigne.
The wines, right? The vineyards.
Where they have these Moroccan workers. They go away in the country for 2 months and then they come back. This was a real farm. We asked the manager the permission, and there was one Tunisian left. I asked him if he would accept. So that was prepared, not rehearsed, but prepared. Sometimes just be people would meet and ask them to do right away. Like when they were building a house, we just arrived and asked if we could do. It's organized, not too much, but it has to be organized, because when I wanted to shoot in that farm where the Tunisian invites her to stay there, it had to be organized. Right. You know. And then Sandrine would be the one teaching him his lines, because he was very shy, and a real film make him feel shy. And Sandrine was very young, and I said, you do with him. Because he was not afraid of Sandrine. She was like a very young girl, and she made him discuss and what he had to say. And this is written, you know. It's interesting because they're non-actor, but they never improvise. It's all written, including their words of testimony, their witnessed words. It's all written. It's a written film. It has a texture of documentary, but it's not at all. It's totally fiction.
One of the most beautiful moments for me is when the Tunisian, instead of offering words, he just smells the scarf. And again, this film about acceptance of smell. Was that something that you had written, or was that a...
It's not written, it's told.
Right. Well, was that something that you had anticipated?
I think he is not using the words as to express himself. And he says nothing to start with, and then he keeps the scarf, is that the word? Yes. But you know, it's another question. When he was alone, he was very friendly and has empathy for her, trying to help her in his way. But when he's taken by the society of people, then their rules are bigger than his empathy, because they don't want a woman around there. And whatever he said, that she's a good woman, they kicked her out, which means he kicks her out because of pressure of the other people. Had that already in One Thing, the Other Dozen, there was an Iranian man. When he's in France, he goes with all the march for the women, but then he takes her in his own country, in Iran. Then she's obliged to be pushed by their law, their society. So, you know, a group is very strong, can be very dangerous or good, but the group is something different than the person. So that's part, they are a side subject in a way, but the main thing is that she doesn't want to share, she doesn't want to work, she hates society, she hates everybody. And the line I would say is, you cannot help somebody who doesn't want to be helped. And whatever is proposed to her, including that philosopher. By the way, he was a real philosopher.
The goat herder.
Who turned into goat maker, goat cheese maker. Well, there were people in those years. Return to earth, return to normal work, no, something that you do every day, you know. And he was a philosophy teacher, and he decided that life. And with his wife, they were working, and the child was raised, you know, in their way, no school, nothing. That, you know, this is still a 68 movement that lasted sort of longer. When I made the film, this is 84 already. Yes.
Yeah, 85.
So, but we still had these characters in the country. And they accepted, and I discussed his character and his line with him. And he said, okay, I'll do it. And some lines that he made up with me because something, but he said, what he explained became what we had to say. Mm-hmm. Well, questions.
Let's take some questions or comments from the audience. Let's take one right here. Lisa Barbash has a question.
Thank you. That was wonderful. I wonder if you could speak a little bit more about the relationship between the script and the characters. At what point did you devise the dialogue that they spoke in relationship to the shooting schedule? Did you write based on the people you met, or did you find people based on your writing?
So how did the dialogue come about? Was the dialogue that the characters speak?
I said, to start with, everything is written by me. But sometimes I got inspired what people had said. You know, the garagist told me, well, I hate these hitchhiker women. And, you know, he had told me that, which allowed me to do writing, and you just say, well, they're worth nothing. But no, there was no improvisation. But I took advantage of things I had heard, or they had told me when I came a month before, or their way of speaking that I noticed and wrote down. I assume that I did that. When in documentaries, I totally respect what people say. I don't ask them to repeat. I don't tell them what they should say. I mean, the documentary school is a totally different way of working. But this is a fiction. And if I understood your question, did I ask them to improvise or something?
No, that wasn't the question.
J'entends pas très bien.
My question was, when did you write the script for them? Did you write a script based on the people that you met? Or you said you went there a month ahead of time, so then did you go home and write the whole script? Or did you improvise the script as you moved along?
No, it's in between, because when I had seen the people we're about to shoot, every morning between 5 and 6, I will write the dialogue of the day. Exact dialogue, because I had ideas, I had heard things. Then the first day when we met and we started to organize the shooting, then I ended up, I would write sometimes even outside on the sur le capot de la voiture, ou quelque chose.
In
that film, the exact dialogue I wrote them at the last minute or the last day. Because I hate to have this kind of strong reaction. I don't want them to be written and given to people to get the money and get furious that we have to reveal so much. So I was vague and say, she speaks with a garagiste, she speaks with something. Then I wrote the dialogue and the words at the last minute, but they were my words, sometimes inspired by something they had said or I had understood, or somebody told them about them. Or, you know, the woman in the cafe, she said, oh, she's lucky, you know, if I could get rid of my husband. And because it's something I heard, maybe not in that cafe, but in another one. I was trying to listen what I could grab from that part of France, which is very close. This is not like the Riviera where everybody speaks, everybody's extroverted. Le Gard, it's a part in which they used to be Protestant. The houses are very close, very fermé, few windows. It's a very strange part. And I chose that also because it's the south. But she dies from the cold because people think that in the north you have to die from the cold, in the south you take the sun. But it's not true, the south can be cold. And we were working with around zero, sometimes less one or plus one. We got frozen when we worked. I mean, we didn't have enough money to have trailers and stuff like this. So we were sharing the story with Sandrine, I must say.
Other questions or comments from this writer? Right over here, Andrew, please.
I noticed in Tavernier's documentary, he mentioned that you bring together opposites. And one of the things that I really admire in your work is the way that you really have a lot of empathy about social issues, but at the same time you have artistic detachment. And I wonder if that's something you work on or if it just comes naturally.
Oh, yeah, the acoustics are a bit strange in the room, so I'll repeat. So this guest mentioned she saw the documentary by Tavernier, you know, his voyage through French cinema. And in that, he says that your films are about contrasts, and she says that she notices that in your films you have a deep empathy for people in the films, but at the same time, you keep a kind of artistic distance at times from them. And she's wondering if you're aware of this contrast or if this is something you work with.
You do think that because we do a nice shot means the distance? That we have to film like it is always? I mean, you know, including documentaries, you can be careful about what you film. So it's a real contradiction because it bites its own tail, is that what you say?
Yeah.
Because you want to make it true in documentary, but I don't want that to be just whatever. So sometimes I set up parts of a documentary, which is still very true. It's very them in their rule, their own rule, their own places. It's something in between. But this is a fiction, so I had to organize it clearly, how the shots would be made, especially all the end, you know, when as you know, notice maybe there is only music on the traveling shots and it becomes stronger and stronger. Pathetic music at the end. The last work she does, and then she ends falling. This is organized, you know. We knew where the, comment dire, tube.
The tube that she trips over?
Yeah, right. It was organized that she would step on that, you know. It's, when it's a fiction, it looks true, but it has been organized, you have to. But but also, I wanted to keep the documentary texture, especially because all the actors, beside Madame Masha Merrill, who plays the tree specialist, and her assistant, these two, all the other people were non-actors. So I spent time with them also, not to make them repeat, but trying to get them into the feeling of the story, what they felt about the girl, how she could hate her, if they agree to be contemptuous or to be funny. In the garage, you know, at the beginning, that day I was not inspired. I didn't write a line. So what do we do now with the Gerhard, the son, the father? And I decided to make a film, a sequence with no words. I don't know if you notice, no one word. Besides,
well, they're looking at each other, right?
No, but what he says, these girls on the road, this is his testimony, is written. But the rest in the garage, the look at the son, the look at the father, the way she behaves with the dog, she puts her tent, the whole thing is just gesture and look and gesture. Because I was out of inspiration for words. But it ends up okay for me. It's interesting to make a scene with no words.
Other questions? Yes, right here, and then we'll.
Hello and welcome to Boston. In
Cambridge.
Cambridge, Harvard. In one of your films, you ask audience, what do you do when you're not happy? And I want to ask you, what do you do when you're not happy?
In one of your films, you ask, what do you do when you're not happy? And she wants to know, what do you do when you're not happy?
Well, I even, in a film I made called Documentaire, an emotion picture, she's with her son. And she said, they go in a new house, that she showed him the room. And she said, see, you will be fine, you will be happy, you will be content, you know. And he turns and says, et si je ne suis pas content, qu'est-ce que tu vas faire? And if I'm not okay, what will you do? So is that the question? What do we do if people are unhappy? Or what do I do personally?
What do you personally do when you're unhappy?
Well, is it about me or about the world? Because I'm not happy to have millions of migrants moving in Europe and drawing in the ocean. I'm not happy about that. And it happens every day. So do we have to discuss if I'm happy because I had a nice dinner?
We did have a nice
dinner. Perfect. We had Japanese food, perfectly perfect. But you see, what I'm saying is that there are layers of being happy, layers about what we feel, who is around us, what do we feel about people we love, what do we feel about the neighbors, about the country, about the world, about, well, the réchauffement climatique, what do you call that?
Global warming.
No, le réchauffement climatique.
Global warming, climate change. Climate change, no?
Yes, climate change, yes. Sorry. So what I'm saying is that we have so many levels, you know. So what is the thing about being happy? We have the classical thing. I made a film about Le Bonheur.
Exactly. That's
which is happiness. And it has layers also, discussion about that. So I never feel myself totally alone when I speak about what I feel. I feel connected with so many things, so many people. So I cannot make it as a personal or intimate statement. Sorry.
Okay, so there's another question right here.
I'm very interested in Mona's boots. And they begin...
Mona's boots. She's very interested in Mona's Le Chasseur de Mona.
So the shape of them changes. So they begin quite formally, and then they become unzipped when the zip breaks, and then they're
so
red.
The zipper breaks, and they sort of open
like
flowers.
Okay, okay. I have to tell you about the shoes. Because this is true. I noticed that these girls on the road didn't have the appropriate shoes. None of them would have like walking shoes, like you go camping or tennis. They had whatever they had. So my daughter, who used to be costume designer for opera and films, I spoke to her about the boots. And we had to understand the aging of the boots were part of the film. They start more or less okay, then the zip, and then it goes. And we had three pairs of boots because she had them made in three different states. Because we couldn't do the film from the first shot to the end for technical reason. We had to do sometimes the end before the beginning. So we had the shoes for the end, the shoes for the middle, and the shoes for the beginning. That's what I say. You know, it looks like reportage, but it has to be organized so that you would believe that her shoes are aging become like middle age, you know, the poulain, je sais pas. And the way it turns, it became middle age shoes, which I found that you see in films, period films. So it's interesting, your question, because it means that we care about all these things. And you notice that we care.
Thank you. Yes, in the very back there, or the yes, Andrew, will you pass them, or somebody?
Hi, I'm so delighted to see you. I remember seeing Cléo de 5 à 7 when I was in high school in Paris, and I've always wanted to see your movies and to have this retrospective. I've seen basically all of them, and I'm going to see Daguerreotype tomorrow. And so what has touched me by looking at all these movies, and especially the documentaries, is your place in it, like Plage d'Agnès, or the, you know, whether it's Jacques de Nantes, or is how you put yourself in it, and you show empathy, you care, and you're ready to share about yourself, your heart. And that's what really has touched me throughout these movies. Thank you.
She's really struck by, she's been watching a lot of the films here at the retrospective, is the way, especially in your documentaries, you are present in the film. And she's impressed by the way that the films, your presence is such a part of the films, your voice, your opinion, your ideas. And she just wanted to comment on that. But I was wondering if we could turn this into a slight question and to ask about the...
It's one of the questions, because my documentaries until 10 years ago, I was doing the narration. It was my voice, but I was not entering in the show. And I did it with the Glean. I did it with Janko, because I was meeting
Janko. Right.
It has to be me, because we were filming the meeting. But later, I disappeared, and I came back when I did the Gleaners. For some reason, it happened that I could, for some reason, be in the film, and I thought, I asked him so much to be there, to speak, to be honest. I should be slightly part of it. Because when you do a documentary, the time you do that, it's your life. You're part of it. You're not like a person out of the show and saying, I look at these people, you know, I observe. I mean, people are not insects, you know. And because we want so much, I want so much to share, to get their feeling, their understanding, to have conversation. I ended up being slightly in the film, but slightly. Not in the Beaches of Agnes, that was normal, because this was a kind of self-portrait. But in the last one, Faces Place, is about the friendship between J.R. and me, among other things. So, you know, when I was young, I never wanted to be an actress, and still never wanted to do that. And ended up being part of the film, as if the film is me also, in a way. Oh, I cannot totally separate myself from the film that I made. It started when I was old already. It's part of my way of aging.
Other questions? Yes, right there, Stephen.
Hello. Thank you so much for your humane and humanist eye. I have two questions. My first question is, I am curious why, at one point, you show Sandrine Bonnaire looking at postcards, and what do those postcards mean?
She's wondering, at one point we see Sandrine Bonnaire looking at postcards, and she wonders what those postcards could mean. Maybe we'll just pause so she can answer that question.
To start with, I love postcards. And I love to, not to collect them like a collector. I have postcards of places I've been living because they make sense for me. And I have a lot of postcards with no meaning, that I love just to go through postcards. So it's something of myself that I put there. But in that case, it's trees only. It's a collection of postcards related to trees. For some reason, I don't remember now. I don't remember. I wanted her to look as if it were a treasure, because people who travel with nothing, they have like the one had a dictionary. Her treasure is 6 or 7 postcards, and she likes to look at them, which I do a lot. I look at, sometimes I have 10 postcards on my table, and I should look at them one after another. Sometimes they're related to birthday or to good New Year. I have postcards for Easter, but I have many postcards from museum because I pick beautiful painting. It's like being in a museum sometimes. I touch them. Well, I like the idea that to have a relationship with postcards. Well, okay, that's why it. So is that the question I didn't answer? But maybe it's useless. It's the way it is.
My second question is the theme of free and freedom that comes over and over again. Can you explain that?
She's just asking, she says that she finds a larger theme about freedom in the film, and this question, obviously, the question about freedom is being both.
Very important. Yep. Freedom as a filmmaker includes the right to have digressions out of the subject, like in The Gleaners, which is a very subject, important people. These people who eat what we throw away. It's a very important. And then at one point, I grab the trucks because I like to do it. You know, it's just existing in a film, even if serious. The last one I made with JR, Faces Places, is really about meeting people. But we allow ourselves to do some side jokes because it's a pleasure to be a filmmaker, you know. I never forget that even treating a very serious subject, we exist, we spend our life, our days, we eat there. Sometimes we sleep in places, hotel, because we want to be near. So filming is not only the act of making a film, it's a way of living. So if some pieces of my own life enter in the film, I don't think it's inappropriate. It's my freedom also to say that. I don't have to say, just explain the subject. If I feel to do a little step on the side and I like it, it's fine.
Well, I think we are going to call it a night, and I want to thank everybody for being here tonight, and I want to ask you to join me in thanking Agnes Varda. Please come back on, go to Sanders Theatre on Monday and Tuesday at 4 o'clock to hear Agnes Varda's 2 Norton lectures. Thank you so much.